my first speaker at this time. That's Bree.
What's your last initial, Bree?
S.
Bree S.
And it's from Rock Creek area. The topic is I was from here.
Do I talk into the microphone?
Talk into the microphone.
Hello, microphone. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm an addict named Bree.
Hey, Bree.
And something wonderful just happened. I was out front pacing. I've been pacing for a while now. It feels a little bit like detox here because I was like walking around in circles and running into the same people. And then I see other people and I was like, I don't know you. I'm afraid of you. Let's hug, which is a really good trick, the hugging thing, because it's my natural, normal tendency to look at people and figure out exactly how different you are from me. And get scared, you know, or try to figure out how to judge you best so I won't be too scared. It's like, you are clearly wrong, and I don't need to be afraid of you. And now I'm going to run away and be alone where I belong. Anyway, though, I was outside admiring the addicts doing their service obligation to Narcotics Anonymous, smoking cigarettes in front of the meeting place. Because, no, really, this is a service. It's a life-saving duty, an obligation for people to stand in front of the meeting place holding coffee cups, smoking cigarettes, and talking dirty, especially in front of churches, because that's how we know where the meetings are. It's really, really important. The only way I know it's an NA meeting is when I see a bunch of people comparing cool tattoos, talking about bodily functions, in disparaging ways, and drinking coffee, you know, just being as inappropriate as is humanly possible. It lets me know that this is the appropriate place for me. It's where I belong. It's the only place I've ever felt like I belonged. The topic, I don't know why Jennifer gave it to me. I'm really honored that you asked me to speak, Jennifer, but I was not eunuch. I was chemically castrated. For real. I mean, you remember, right? I mean, when I talk about I love drugs, that's like such a gross understatement, right? I don't love drugs. I need drugs. I adore drugs. Drugs are more important to me when I'm using them than my mother, my sisters, my father. I mean, to say that I was chemically castrated, it's true, I was. There were times when she was lying there waiting for me. I love you, come. And I would say, in a minute, baby. I'll be right there. I forgot something at the grocery store. I'll be right back. You know? I mean, really, in terms of an unnatural relationship, I can't say that I would rather get high than have sex, but when I'm getting high, sex is most definitely secondary. And for me, towards the end, my dick was a rather unnecessary appendage. You know, it was just kind of there. Which is weird because I've spent most of my life very, very preoccupied with my dick, you know. And one of the things about getting clean, one of the really weird things about getting clean for me was like, you know, in detox, suddenly everything was coming back to life. It was a bitch. I couldn't sleep. There were lung sounds. There were bowel sounds. And I couldn't lie on my belly. Right? And then you get here and your sponsor says, no sex for the first year. And it's like, what? Huh? What? You mean I can't get fucked up and I can't get fucked? But anyway, I was outside and I met these two men, James and James, and it was really cool because I'd never met them before. And then I was sitting here feeling like I was on death row about to make a complete fool of myself, which I will do, I promise. And I saw them walk in. And that is really, really magical for me. 'Cause what I need in Narcotics Anonymous is support. And what I often need to do, which I did a lot today, is admit it. Admit that I need help. And that was something that for my life, for my entire life, and that was before I started using drugs, I could never do. Because as soon as I asked for help, it meant I had to admit how I'd fucked up a bunch of stuff to get where I was to need help. And it was always hard for me to admit that I was in any way deficient, because you guys were always telling me I was deficient, and I didn't need to admit it. Everybody was always after me with a baseball bat, saying, you know, you're so smart, you should be doing so well in school, why do you keep fucking up, why did you break that window, why did you light that on fire, why? And I always answered the same thing. I always answered, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Will you ever do it again? Will you ever do it again? Oh no, I'll never do it again. anybody remember? For me, I can remember saying, I'll never do it again. Like, I think I was at the headmaster's office. I said, I'd never do it again. And I was thinking, as I said it, exactly when and how I was going to do it again as soon as I got out of his fucking office. And that day, I remember stealing his big, he had one of those big giant fountain pen things, you know, the big, huge ones on his desk. I pinched that fucker. Because, man, one of the things I hate, I always hated, was when people put me on the spot like that. I love you. I love you. I need you. I want to stay married to you. Please stop this. And I say, yeah, I'll stop it. You ever going to do it again? I'll never do it again. I knew from a very young age that as soon as my obsession kicks in, as soon as I get stuck on a thought, I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop thinking about it. It just goes on and on and on. And as soon as I get stuck in an obsessive cycle, as soon as that agitation fucking washing machine with the rocks in it starts going ka-chung, 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 as soon as that happens, there's no point in me resisting it. Resistance is futile. It's going to go on until I fucking do it. And the only way I ever got any peace and quiet and relief from the noise in my head was by breaking the window, talking out of turn, saying, telling the teacher exactly what was wrong with her. I spent most of my time in school. They had me out in the hall. They just kept me in the hall. All you guys were doing your homework. They put me out in the hall. It was lonely out there. But I hated you all. It was really tough because I was sitting there hating on you and feeling like really lonely in the hall. Occasionally some other reprobate would be put out in the hall with me and we'd throw stuff at each other. Anyway, I'm cross-eyed, I'm short, I can't fight for shit, and my name is Bree. You know, that started when I was like 5-4 years old. Like the cheese? Yes, like the cheese. I can't fight, so I had to be a smartass. I have to protect myself somehow. I was born like blind, so that for like a lot of my first years of life, I had an eye patch over one eye. And my mother used to say, he's so accident prone. I was walking into shit all the time. You know, all you guys were playing baseball and football and stuff. All that ever happens to me when there's a ball in the air is it hits me in the head really hard. I was, as a baseball player, I wanted to put like neat's foot oil in my eye because I was always getting hit right there. It was sad. I come from a family of addicts. My father died of our disease. My mother is wet-brained from all the vodka she drank. She just kind of makes up her reality as she goes along, and occasionally when she shakes her head, you can hear like a whooshing sound from all the residual vodka up there. My uncle died of our disease. And for as long as I can remember, I never really wanted to be where I was. I never felt comfortable as a member of my family. I was always ashamed of my parents' behavior. They fought and were crazy and ridiculous and noisy and stinky and doing what we do. and it was tough. And in school, I was always awake when you were asleep and asleep when you were awake, and they always threw me out. And I never felt right there. I never felt right for my whole life because my nose is too big and I'm too short and I'm too blind and I probably have body odor and my breath is bad. And back to my dick, it's got a little bend in it, which I spent for years trying to straighten, you know. And with the years, I've realized I have problems with dick image. Other people have problems with body image. I've always been so busy worried about my dick image that I didn't even notice the whole body image thing. It must be terrible. But for me, I was an accident waiting to happen because I never felt any modicum of comfort in my own skin. My skin is too tight or too loose or something. I don't feel right being around people. I find it awkward. I'm always afraid you're going to punch me in the nose or laugh at me. Don't laugh. Recovery's really serious, everybody. When I found drugs, it was right. It was the first time for any sustained period that I felt okay being me. It didn't matter I couldn't dance. I could dance. It didn't matter I couldn't catch a ball. I could catch a ball, I thought. It didn't matter I was afraid to talk to women. I could. I could actually, the coolest thing for me when I started getting high was I went from being a hyperactive underachiever to being just an underachiever. It was great. I finally belonged. for me, it was always ridiculous to hear someone talk about partying drugs or doing them as some kind of a special occasion. because for me, drugs were like food. I needed them from the get-go. You know, when it started with the marijuana, man, I'm from New York, and I used to think that I was so smooth that I could smoke on the way to school on the subway train. No one could possibly notice. I'm so cool. And from then on, from the first hit on, I needed to get high because I never felt comfortable without it. And every time I tried to stop, that obsessive thing would kick in. And I don't know whether any of you have ever done this before, but for me, when I say in the morning, I am not going to get high, I start saying it a lot. I say, I'm not going to get high. And then I say, I'm not going to get high. And then I say, I'm not going to get high. And then I start thinking about it. I think, wow, I'm really thinking about not getting high a lot. I'm not going to get high. And then it's like, it turns into like that Bugs Bunny routine with Daffy Duck when they're arguing with each other about whether it's duck season or rabbit season, duck season, rabbit season, duck season, rabbit season. And yeah, exactly. And Daffy says, duck season, shoot me now. And for me it was, I'm going to get high. And with the years and with all the different drugs, each drug that I ever loved, and I loved them all, the good part went away. I used them up. I got to a point where I'd sucked all the marrow out that bone. My carburetor wasn't dealing with rocket fuel very well. It had fallen off a few miles back. And where marijuana had allowed me to be cool and relaxed, suddenly I was all paranoid and cold-faced and couldn't think a solid thought, stupid, stoned, retarded, and paranoid. You know, the drug of my foreparents, the one that you can get clean from and clean with, ethanol. You know, when I was first a guzzlin, man, the first time I ever put down a quart of beer on the Brooklyn Promenade, man, it was perfect. I thought I was taller. I was smarter. I could talk faster even though I was slurring a little bit. You know, dance like Cary Grant. I'm charming with really bad breath. But in the end, man, in the end, I became my father. The same critical, sarcastic, down-looking, nasty son of a fuck that my dad was, man. I would cut you up to make myself feel better. It was necessary. And late at night with the wife, beating on her. Beating on her because I hate myself so damn much. And it got to that point, I don't know whether you've ever been there before, but in the morning when I was just trying to get my wake up down, I couldn't smoke a cigarette in the morning because I was puking up that black, biley, bloody shit, and I had to drink a little something just to smoke my morning cigarette. And it went from being a nice, rosy buzz, happy high for a little while to just, it was either I needed something, or I was all fucked up all over again. Nasty and passing out. And I'll never forget the times when I was sitting on a street corner and a kid would come near and his mother or father would say, "Get away from that man. Get away from that man." I'll never forget that feeling. Unique and alone. Utterly and completely alone. And it happened more and more with Coke. Coke, come on, man, you remember? Coke, the first time I put a little pinky full of, like, pink champagne Coke in my nose, it was like, I want to be like this for the rest of my life. I love this. But then, man, in the end, do you remember? Do you remember watching those goody two-shoes motherfuckers going to work? You know, I'm sitting there with a knife, like my favorite carving knife, between my legs, shaking, saying, "When they're going to come and get me?" Thinking I better call 911 and knowing full well I was going to be calling 911 on myself. Every creak in the house representing someone coming down. And then there was dope. Come on now. You know, the first time I ever chomped me down a little bit of morphine sulfate coated content, it was perfect. I grew 2 inches. My dick was bigger. I could clean the house. I loved cleaning. Suddenly I was, you know, able to do all the things I hated doing. I was great at cleaning. I was nice to people. It was perfect. And for me, check this out. When I found dope, it was after I had been diagnosed with full-blown AIDS. I injected myself with HIV a long, long time ago in New York. I injected myself with a heart murmur. I injected myself with hepatitis C. And still, my name was Bree, and I was a straight guy with AIDS, college-educated. Fucking alone, completely unique. Not like anybody. But I was working in this AIDS organization, and people used to bring all the dead people's drugs to this organization, and they elected me keeper of the dead people's pharmacy. Cuz you know, I may not be able to speak many languages, but I can speak pharmaceutical desk reference. You know, if you want to hear the name of a compound, I can give it to you. And so they're bringing me, like, shopping bags full of drugs, and the families don't know the difference between a potent antifungal or an antimicrobial and a analgesic. The ones with all the little stickers on them with the sleepy eyes and do not drive heavy machinery and the stuff you gotta fucking almost die to get. I mean, I don't... You know the names. I mean, patches and liquids and... Oh, man. And I was supposed to take I was supposed to take all the good shit into the bathroom and flush it down the toilet. Right? They call us drug abusers. I don't abuse drugs. I love drugs. I mean, I don't know which is a worse sound, when she says, we have to talk, or when the toilet flushes with my drugs in it. I got to say, it's probably the toilet. That's the worst sound in the world. Then she says, we have to talk. I don't want to talk. So I had all the drugs, all the narcotics imaginable. I mean, oh, just so much dope. It was crazy. And I didn't even know I had a habit for like 6 months or something. And I had AIDS, and I was supposed to die. And I remember telling my father that I had injected myself with AIDS, and I remember waiting to die. And I've never been so alone, except when I started using dope. And getting to a point, despite the fact that I'd managed to marry a doctor when I had full-blown AIDS, and I was getting all the dope in the world, that point when I don't know if you guys have been there, but I do not like letting anybody else have control of my drugs. So I was out copping dope in South Williamsburg in Brooklyn, no immune system whatsoever, and shooting whatever I could get my hands on into my arm. Is it almost time? What's coming?
8 minutes.
8 minutes. Maybe I should talk about recovery soon. But there came a time when, you know, one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. And with that wife who could write me a note that I could get cashed at any pharmacy in the land, and with all those drugs coming from all the dead people with AIDS, and with whatever money I had, there came a time when there just wasn't enough. There came that time, and I know those of you have used that drug, when at 5 o'clock in the morning I'd be trying to stay in bed but couldn't do it because I felt like a butterfly with a needle right through its central part, every bone in my body aching, my wings all spread out in pain. And I knew I had to go out and get that shit. And I knew, too, by the time I got busted. Oh, yeah, what gave me my willingness to come to Narcotics Anonymous? Handcuffs. It was handcuffs. Uh-huh. But I knew I'd be selling my AIDS drugs to buy dope. I knew that I couldn't do it. I couldn't stop. Every time I'd get a stash big enough to kick. you ever get a big kick stash before? It's really amazing, because whenever I got that big kick stash, I had to have one last good hit. And then there wasn't enough left to kick. Or a suicide stash. Any of you ever done that? I always thought it would be expedient to have a suicide stash in the house just in case. But for me, every time I got enough drugs to commit suicide, I didn't feel very suicidal anymore. So I came to NA, and I came from New York, and it was really, really hard for me because I never had any religion, and we meet in churches, and these people were talking about their stupid, ridiculous feelings, like the fucking Carpenter song or something. Feelings, la, 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 la. And it drove me crazy. It drove me nuts to sit in a meeting. And when people tried to hug me, it was horror. I was coming off dope, and here were all you people talking about a painful hangnail or a split end or how your boss was mean to you or your therapist told your analyst told your mother that blah, blah, blah. Shut the fuck up. And I sat there and I was dying. But what I heard you guys say was thanks for sharing, which is a really weird thing for someone like me to hear. Because, man, I don't share too well. And I came to meetings and something began to happen for me that is a miracle. When I hear you talk about the parts of me that I hate most, the things that I would never tell you about, that I would never admit, when I hear you talk about how you want to get high, or how you hate living here, or how you can't get along with people, or how your job sucks. When I hear you talk about these things that I hate in me, I love you for it. Because the love that we have here, the thanks for sharing, the hugs, the listening, the honesty, gives me courage to talk about myself, to be free of the bondage that I've always been under, of my obsession and my conviction that I am unique and no one can possibly fucking understand me. You don't understand. I'm not hurting anybody. Can you lend me $20? I never felt at home at my dinner table. I never felt like I was part of my family. I thought I must be the misbegotten bastard son Oswald or some odd shit, like with the hunchback. But man, I come to Narcotics Anonymous meetings and I know I belong. And the way I get comfortable in Narcotics Anonymous meetings, the way I earn my chair here, is not from all the drugs I did. The way I earn my chair at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting is I sit in it really a lot so it's comfortable. And if I'm uncomfortable just sitting in the chair, what I do is I get a service position. You know what the coffee maker is at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting? The drug dealer. Everybody loves you when you make coffee for us. You know, and if anybody, you know, I always felt uncomfortable coming to a party if I didn't have the best shit. Coffee maker's got the best shit. So if there's any discomfort with the hugging and the clicks and the way I felt so alone and out of place at my first meetings, getting a service position really helped me a lot. It helped me feel like I was part of this, and I needed that desperately. And then finally, I guess, I've been part of hospitals and institutions subcommittee for a long time. I take meetings into facilities where people are still real fucked up on drugs. And I love it. I love it because it's about dope. It's not about anything but dope. And about, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, I was going to a big facility and it was New Year's Eve. And all my friends were waiting at the marathon meeting in D.C. And I was dying to be with them and there was lots of traffic getting out there. And I got there just on time, but the door was locked, and they didn't let me in, and I was cursing and just hating on the world. I went behind the detox facility, and there were like 3 deer and a fox. It was some weird Disney movie. And then they let me into the detox facility, and I got in, and the place was filled with people in various horrible stages of withdrawal from every drug imaginable. Man, they were fucked up. There were some nodding out and bumping their heads on the table. Others were swinging around on the chandeliers. And it hit me, man. I never, ever felt okay on New Year's Eve. I was always at the wrong party. I was always not right, man. I wasn't tuned. I wasn't, this drug wasn't working with that drug. I was puking. I was stuck in traffic. I never had a New Year's Eve I could stand. But that night, being in a detox with a bunch of fucking withdrawing drug addicts, dying to get clean, dying to get what we have, what we give each other every day here, it hit me, man. I knew I was in the right place. I knew I was where I belonged. I knew, more important, I knew I wanted to be there. I wanted to be there. I want to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I've been alone and I've been unique for most of my life. What saves me on a provisional basis day to day is admitting to you and to myself that I'm an addict. And that gives me the ability to be with you, to be part of us, to be part of this miracle. And man, here we are all together. Congratulations for being here. Congratulations. I hope you have the best weekend ever. And thanks so much for listening to me.
Three S. I'd like to introduce myself.